4 minutes past nine this Tuesday, the 1st of September 2026, and you're very welcome along to the Greg Hughes Show, and it's another bumper show for you. Lots to keep you updated and interested in. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and the text number, 086 60 25000. You can also give us a call on 074 91 25000. Or email comments at highlandradio.com to invite you to watch the show if it suits you. We're on X and YouTube just for the time being. On YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, across your mobile devices and on your big TV, your smart TV and your Fire Stick, and on X as well. Right, lots to get through, so let's crack on with the newspapers. And change is afoot if you are found by Gardaí to be in possession of drugs, a quantity that would be deemed as personal use, not dealing drugs, because there is an alternative now. And I read from the Irish Daily Mail that adults caught by Gardaí with small quantities of illegal drugs may, from today, be referred to health services for rehabilitation rather than prosecuted. An Garda Síochána said it will implement the health referral scheme from today. The pilot programme has been developed by the Department of Health and the Department of Justice in partnership with the HSE and the Gardaí. The aim of the scheme is to provide a health-based response to people found in possession of drugs and who meet a certain set of criteria. Garda Commissioner Justin Kelly said the health referral scheme is a positive development, and An Garda Síochána has been working closely with government stakeholders to prepare for implementation of this policy. The commencement of this scheme allows his members to support harm reduction by offering first-time offenders to refer them to the health services. Now, I don't know what that looks like. So if you're found with cannabis, I don't know what the HSC services are that you'd be referred to, or how they're funded, or where they're at. But anyway, this is what they're going with. It doesn't mean that they can't find you. It just means that they have an option to refer you. That's the first time. But if you're a regular drug user, I don't know then what happens if you were, if you came to their attention a second time. We'll try and get more information on that for you down the line. Interesting article on employment in this country. It's from the Irish Times. It's in a lot of papers today, because obviously we have what would be described as full employment percentage-wise. Do you know what I mean? There's factors, and we are at full employment, but it doesn't tell the full picture, because they've done a bit of an analysis, and there's a lot of particularly young people in jobs where their pay doesn't allow them to actually support themselves. So you might have a younger person, maybe they've just, you know, graduated with the Guards, or maybe there's less well-paid jobs down the country, so they're in Galway or Dublin or somewhere. They're earning a reasonable wage, but by the time they pay their rent, pay for their food, pay for their broadband, and have a little bit of a social life, they've got nothing left. And there's lots and lots of people, it seems, in that situation. So the number of young people in work remains well below pre-economic crash levels, and a growing number are in jobs that do not pay well enough to allow them to live independently as adults, according to a report by TASC for the National Youth Council of Ireland. The report suggests youth unemployment has fallen sharply since peaking at 32% in the wake of the financial crisis. Yet more than 100,000 fewer young people are working now compared with 20 years ago. It says that figure recovered well until the start of the decade, but has stalled at about 320,000 since then, while employment among other groups has continuously increased. The proportion of the younger workers, those under 20, on below minimum wage has doubled from 15 to 31%, it suggests. A serious youth employment strategy must focus not only on whether young people are employed, but on whether they can access decent work, adequate income, secure housing, and a realistic pathway to an independent life in Ireland. So I wonder, many of you out there, do you have young people in your lives, and they're grafters, they're out there working, but you see that by the end of the month, and maybe they're not flaunting their cash, but by the end of the month, they're skint again. You know, and how do you progress from that, I suppose, with promotions and all that type of stuff. Feature on a young woman who I hope has a very thick skin, because she's putting herself out there as the new, sort of as the Irish version of Greta Thunberg. Olivia Fahi is her name. She's just 17 from Dublin, and she's set up a new website called Youth for Earth. And unfortunately, if you step into the space of climate and activism, you get a target on your back. It shouldn't be the case. I think we should be able to live in a world where some people believe one thing and others believe another, and it doesn't become personal. But here we are. I just hope that she has good people around her, because she's going to get a lot of abuse, sadly, and it's as predictable as death. An Irish teenager who says she's inspired by Greta Thunberg has gained close to 40,000 followers online after setting up a climate change movement. When I turned 15, I realised that I was only one person, that I was limited in my reach and the change I can create, said Olivia Fahey, 17, from Butrus Town in Dublin. I came up with Youth for Earth to empower other young people like me to be able to make changes and to be taken seriously. Youth for Earth is an online forum with more than 650 members where young people can discuss and vote on proposals for climate change campaigns. And as I say, you know, these are the people. It's their planet. We'll all be gone. And Olivia and her peers and those coming behind her will have to inherit what we've left behind us. So at least she's doing something. But as I say, I just have a feeling she's going to be, unfortunately, subject to a lot of online abuse. Pubs are continuing to close. Is this just part of the way we are now? We don't drink as much as we used to. We don't need as many pubs then, do we? I mean, I always thought there were certain towns that there were far too many pubs, that it was artificially, you know, inflated how many pubs that were there, and it was inevitable that a certain amount of them were going to close. But anyway, up to 1,000 pubs will close in the next decade if the government doesn't help struggling boozers, an economist has warned. Ireland is grappling with a diminishing nightlife, as a new report revealed on average over 100 pubs annually cease trading since 2005. Despite a growing population, a report from the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland shows a rapid decline, with rural areas being most affected. Last year, 86 pubs called time for good, which is up from 65 closures in 2024, but down from 117 in 2023. The reality is though, I mean, unless you're drinking 0.0, if you're having a drink and you go to the pub, how are you getting home? It's a struggle. It's a struggle even in big towns, and sometimes even more of a struggle in big towns than in rural areas. Then there's a cost of drinking. It costs a fortune. It feels like it costs a fortune as well. So you factor all that in, and people are doing different things. They're not going to the pub. And if they're not going to the pub in as big a numbers, and if people are drinking less, well, then you need less pubs. And it's just an industry that probably, and I don't want to pee anyone off in it, that, you know, you're going to have the pubs that survive because they're very popular, and maybe they've got the late licenses, and, you know, they make money off food and all that type of stuff. And then you've got boozers that, you know, that my dad used to drink in, for an example, whereby you just go in and you sit and you have your pints and then you leave. You know, those pubs are going to struggle because there would have been a daytime crowd too, I suppose, that would keep the lights on, and then you make your money at the weekend. I don't know. I'm not sure the government can do anything to address businesses closing because less people need those businesses. It's going to be tight. And as I say, I don't mean that in any way to cast shade on the industry. I think it's just a reality. If people are generally drinking less, then you generally need less pubs, don't you? And Donegal interest in The Traitors is over. I've never watched an episode of The Traitors, and I'm not saying that with any pride. It's just not a programme that would appeal to me. There was a Donegal interest again this year, unfortunately, for her. She is out. Sorry if you haven't watched it yet. But anyway, two contestants were axed from Traitors Ireland last night, and another pair stunned viewers when their relationship was revealed. Vocal coach Emma 42 was murdered, lovely language, was murdered before breakfast, while Adele 44 was later banished at the first round table. However, the biggest surprise came when it emerged Diego, 40, and Dennis, 39, are actually married, a secret they managed to keep hidden from the rest of their fellow contestants. Well, I presume they just didn't tell them. It's not hard to keep a secret, is it? You just don't tell people. But anyway, there you go. That's a twist. Some of the reports from people who are Traitors fans told me that it wasn't as they weren't sort of as impressed with this the new first two episodes as they were a previous series. I don't know, as I say, and maybe it's something you want to talk about. We're going to talk now about a European Commission decision to ban beef, Brazilian beef, that is, from the EU market. Adam Woods is news editor at the Irish Farmers Journal and is kind enough to join us. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right, so there was an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing about, you know, deals to get Brazilian beef into the EU market, a lot of pushback from farmers from various reasons, investigations by your own newspaper about how, you know, easy it is to get hold of certain products to enhance the growth of beef, but with a detriment to human health. And now we're in a situation where it's the EU Commission looking, or is now looking, to ban the product. It's only just really okay to come into the region. Is that kind of where we're at?
Yeah, that's it. I guess the EU Commission have moved to ban Brazilian beef from the 3rd of September. And that's on the back of Brazil not being able to ratify that their beef that they're exporting to Europe hasn't got illegal hormones or hasn't got antibiotics in it. There isn't a recording mechanism or system in Brazil. I visited there in October 25, spent a number of weeks there travelling across the country, visiting farms, visiting co-ops and stores. And we were able to, we obtained undercover footage, video footage of myself going into these, we'll say, co-ops and stores, purchasing antibiotics, high-level antibiotics, critical-level antibiotics, without herd numbers, without tag numbers, without prescriptions, without any Portuguese, to be honest. We had just English, and we were just pointing at the antibiotics on the shelves that we wanted, and we got them. And so there was no recording of purchase, no recording of sale, and then there was no recording of what animals got it. So there's 230 million animals in Brazil, and to put in a system where antibiotics can be recorded, that will take a long time. So obviously they don't have proof that they're adhering to the standards that Europe holds its own farmers to, including Irish farmers. And with that reason, they've banned the beef.
So as much as we can determine, when did the EU Commission allow the sale or import and sale of Brazilian beef into the EU?
So we've been importing, we'll say, I figured here for the last sort of back to 2010, and we've been importing sort of between sort of 20 and 30,000 ton into Europe on an annual basis. That has actually ramped up. We just got the figures yesterday for January to June 2026. And during that period in 2025, we imported 30,000 ton into Europe of Brazilian beef. During the same period in 2026, that increased to 47,000 ton. So EU beef production has been declining in recent years, and that gap was being filled by Brazilian beef, and that now creates maybe an opportunity for Irish beef and other countries to fill that gap, I guess, that Brazil now will vacate in terms of the European market.
Is there any appetite, do you think, or any prospect of the European Commission giving Brazil an opportunity? In other words, allowing the importation of Brazilian beef whilst it gets its house in order.
So there was some thoughts around that. The current practice in Brazil is that if there's 90 days sight on, we'll say, large feedlots on antibiotic use in those feedlots, then that beef is okayed for Europe. But the latest move from the Commission has now banned it completely until Brazil can prove that their animals haven't received antibiotics during their lifetime. And if you take the life cycle of an animal, that's probably 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. So I think it will be a long time before Brazil comes back into the market in terms of European beef market. There is audits due to take place, and there will be further audits in the next couple of months to determine what Brazil are doing. But 230 million cattle, it's very, very hard to put a system in place there. It's not like Ireland where you have small family farms maybe, and it's easy to record use. Out there, there's root and branch system changes from co-ops right to printing labels on bottles, right to usage. So this is a big, big job for Brazil to get in line.
Yeah, but just help me with the timeline here, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of re-asking a question. There's an interim Mercosur deal that's been in effect since May 1st. Now, your investigation and the big pushback from the Irish farmers was saying, look, this deal can't go ahead for a number of reasons, not least because this beef cannot be trusted. So those calls were ignored. And yet here we are, what, June, July, August, September, 4 months later. And the EU is now itself saying, oh, actually, you know, we can't really stand over this Brazilian beef for EU members. Can you square that circle for me?
So I guess the Mercosur trade deal involves a number of countries, including Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay. So the Mercosur trade deal, this does not affect the Mercosur trade deal. This is just country specific to Brazil.
Understood.
So the other countries can still export beef to Europe. They have provided evidence that their standards are high enough to get into Europe. So it's just Brazil. And I guess that was always our argument as regards similar standards. Brazil doesn't have similar standards to European beef farmers.
So the EU would probably argue that they needed to get this deal over the line and then they could scrutinise the more troublesome elements of it rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, there may be some of that. I guess the EU would say that it was a result of an audit during the summer that Brazil now are being banned. There's two sides to this. I guess one side says Europe went on to push through Mercosur earlier on in 2026. And on the other side, then you're saying, and to be honest, I tend to be on the other side in terms of I'm saying this is a welcome move. I think we've called for the Commission to act on this for a long time. And now they have acted on it. And they've been brave on that because I'm sure there's pressure there from Europe in terms of trade and trade with Brazil. I know Brazil are up in arms at the moment. Their umbrella body for meat factories over there are criticising the Brazilian government for not moving on this before now. So there's chaos over there in relation to getting access to that European market. But I think it's a very welcome move for the Commission, and it's the right move because we have shown, as I said last October, November, we've had hormone beef get into the EU food chain, and it's the right move to adhere to standards. We've some of the highest standards in the world. We protect our European citizens with a lot of rules around food safety, and we shouldn't be afraid to apply those rules to other countries as well.
Right, so just final question to be as clear as I can be for listeners. There's always been a bit of Brazilian beef knocking about, right? Pre the interim Mercosur deal, etc. Does this mean all Brazilian beef is banned from the EU market, or are there other channels that are okay? And I presume it doesn't extend to, you know, other meats.
Yeah, so it extends to poultry. So poultry is in that, and other products and other food products, including honey. The complicating factor, and maybe one for your listeners, because it's obviously a border county, is that the UK obviously isn't a member of Europe anymore, and they are open to trade with Brazil. So in relation to, we'll say, Brazilian beef coming into the UK market and coming across Northern Ireland, yes, that has happened in the past, where some of that is filtered across the border in terms of no checks, I guess, on that border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. So yes, there is some concern there that maybe some Brazilian beef might sift into the southern market. The big one for me is the UK market. I guess that Brazil won't direct a lot of their beef now that was going to Europe into that UK market, because that would severely impact Irish beef farmers,
our
because
exports,
the UK is a big market for us.
Interesting. And very, very finally, you're of the view that there's no quick fix to this, that this is a medium to long term situation. You've seen the scale of the industry over there, and you've seen the scale of the lack of regulation. You don't anticipate, do you, Adam, any quick fix from a Brazilian perspective?
No, I don't think so. We were on farms where they were ad lib feeding Momensin. Momensin's an in-feed antibiotic. That's we'll say root. That happens on a lot of farms over there as regards in-feed antibiotics, and that's a big no-no from antimicrobial resistance. So there's huge changes to take place over there, and I think that will take a long, long time for Brazil to rectify.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. That's Adam Woods, news editor at the Irish Farmers Journal. Joe Sweeney is chair of the Donegal Irish Farmers Association and has been listening to our chat there, but of course is well briefed on the subject in any case. Joe, your reaction to this decision?
Yeah, delighted for that decision, because for Ireland to compete with the likes of Brazil, it wasn't a level playing field because of the antics that were going on in Brazil with the use of antibiotics and their traceability. So I'm delighted, because we have to jump hoops here to through European legislation to produce good food at high standards. So we're just delighted that this has happened. But at the same time, it's not the end game, because there will be other challenges in the road ahead. But it's a great decision. We've known this from sort of mid-June, we were in Brussels and we met the commissioner, and he did give us his word that, that it was going to be banned from the 3rd of September.
What about the potential for it to damage our exports to Britain if Brazil looks for alternative markets and starts trying to flog this this beef to the to Britain and Northern Ireland?
Well, it can and will have an impact, all right. But if it's known, there's always a market for good food, and there's always people that will buy good food. It doesn't matter what the cost is. The cheaper foods will come in, but it'll be a bit like the case of the Kerrygold butter going to the US, and then some of the local co-ops now are trying to put in a cheaper version. But how it's working, I'm not too sure, because a brand's brand, and a lot of it sticks by that brand.
Yeah, for
people
sure.
People are loyal to the brand.
Yeah, exactly. But you believe this is good news, that this is a welcome bit of news for the Irish beef industry?
It is. It is. For the time being, it is. Because okay. we couldn't compete. It wasn't a level playing field.
All right. Thanks very much, Joe. Joe Sweeney, chair of the Donegal Irish Farmers Association, of course, says, what about other meat? Should we have more concern about where our chicken is coming from? Well, you may have heard Adam reference that this ban extends to poultry as well. Another question, is this a total ban on Brazilian beef? Well, that's what I was trying to ask. The question I was trying to ask is, you know, there's Wagamo or whatever, there's certain cuts of beef. I'm not sure if it falls under all of this, you know, or if it depends on how it's farmed. But anyway, as far as I'm aware, this is a ban on Brazilian beef. No Brazilian beef will be allowed into this country at all, asked that listener. Again, that was our understanding of it. No sausages, mince, etc. Well, mince sausages are generally, they're not cows, so that's not beef. I'm not sure about the pork side of things. Mince is, if it's derived from Brazilian beef, it's a beef product from Brazil and should be banned. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Mr. Michael Sugrue. Good morning, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us, and good to speak to you again.
Thank you for asking me to come on, Greg. It's nice to talk to you.
And it's off the back of some commentary out there from you. You were in interview with a national newspaper, and the headline they've chosen, "We rechristened our kitchen the law library." Right. So what's the basis of this article, Michael?
Well, it goes back to a case that went through the High Court, where an action was taken basically against me for a potential breach of duty and so on and so forth. And this started in about 2022. And I became aware of it in January 2022. I'd never been to court before. And I suppose in a roundabout way, a patient was saying that, you know, something wrong had happened. And, you know, ultimately, I'm the person who's responsible for this. And this went to court. And this was a new avenue as a consultant for about 30 years. I hadn't ever been physically in court before. And I had no idea what to expect. I remember cancelling my May holidays that weekend, that time in Connemara, we were going, and I didn't know, would I be 2 weeks in court or 3 weeks? But I ended up being basically 2.5 years in court. And it was an extremely traumatic event, Greg. It involved so much work to ensure that my name was cleared, that the unit's name was cleared, and that when I left Letterkenny, that it wouldn't be a stigma that I would have to bear for the rest of my life, along with Pauline and the kids, having spent, you know, a career in surgery over 35 years. I was just so happy that it had a good outcome. But the specific title that you asked me about reflects the amount of work that it took to defend my clinical decision-making. And it was a very stressful time. Hundreds of hours were involved in researching the case, It was equivalent to an entire summer's research program that I used to run with medical students, in the equivalent of producing 5 medical papers. So that was kind of where the Ellen in the Irish Times, who reported on the case during the case, and one of the few papers to actually report on the outcome.
And that's actually another part of this conversation. It's useful to get that message out there. I mean, you are very studious. You're very clinical in your approach. You're very thorough. Would one of your colleagues have had the same outcome, do you think, if they weren't able to put so much, I suppose, technical research into this as you were able to do in your defence?
Well, if I go back a tiny step, Greg, and say that to be summoned to the High Court to defend your actions is pretty unnerving. I mean, it's something that was new to me. And when I discussed it with my colleagues, they said, oh my God, you know, they felt very sorry for me and said, look, perhaps you should just settle this. This is really going to have an impact on you. And I really didn't want it to be settled. And I asked for it not to be settled so that to commit to this, you actually had to take significant time. I had to go in person, compulsorily go for 3 days that I was cross-examined. But in order to understand the nuances of the case, I went for nearly the entire hearings, which were roughly 25 days in the High Court and subsequently in the Court of Appeal. Each day that there was a sitting with the High Court Justice, there would be a briefing document, and that document would be the transcripts of the day's events, which were generally between 40 and 80 pages. I would have had to read those every night. The court sat 3 times a week, and this went on over weeks and months. So you never got away from it, Greg. So I suppose if I wasn't committed to it, they could have settled perhaps on the fourth or sixth week of the trial.
Well, just in relation to that point, because as you quite rightly pointed out, very few cases go to the High Court. You wanted to go there and prove your innocence, to test the evidence, etc. Have you, and I think this might actually be referenced in the article, I presume the majority then don't. The majority either settle or there's negative findings against them. And what kind of an impact has that had on colleagues that have reached out to you?
Well, I've had so many people talk to me after the case was complete. Not many knew it was going on specifically. But subsequently, and even today, I've had, you know, hundreds of people contact me and say, you know, this is so important that you're speaking out about the difficulty for a consultant or a family doctor, for someone who's practicing, to be involved in a medical legal case. The time involvement away from work is huge. Your own personal time, Greg. And so instead of doing nice summer research projects with 5 students, my research project was to save the unit. Because the reality is if you lose a case like this in a Model 3 hospital, there is a potential that someone's going to decide, oh, this is not fit for purpose and we're going to close it. And that would have meant that, you know, up to 2,500 to 3,000 ladies would have had to go elsewhere for their care. And I could see that potentially happening. So, you know, when you see the 6 o'clock news, and I know Highland Radio is not a sensational station, but there are others who have maybe a slightly different view. And, you know, you often come in at 6 o'clock, or you'd hear it on the 6 o'clock news, and you would hear, you know, so-and-so found guilty of this or that. And that's pretty upsetting. And I know of some surgeons who have actually retired from their practice on the basis of negative findings in the High Court.
How do we deal with this going forward? Are you just a victim, and I'll use that word, of a system that needs to be there, or can it be refined? Because, of course, and no one cares more about patients than you, we have to balance the need for accountability and pathways to pursue sort of genuine cases. And in this case, it may well have been genuinely held, but ultimately unprovable and inaccurate, actually, I should say, as the three-judge panel found out and the appeal. But my point being is, how do we... is this a necessary evil of the job, or are there changes? And if changes is required, how do we also ensure, though, that, you know, those that need to be held accountable are?
Well, first of all, I'm not really a victim. I'm a fighter, Greg. So there is a concept of the second victim. I don't class myself as that. I class myself as someone who's very principled and wants to stand up for right and wrong. Yes, there are opportunities to change the system. And it shouldn't be that I have to spend years defending myself. I had to cancel clinics, the operating theatre on numerous occasions, because we're talking of very significant amounts of money involved in these medical legal cases. There were some humorous times, Greg, when I received mass cards and different things. So, you know, people thought I was sick or I'd retired. Mm. And you know, this affects not just me, Pauline and my friends, but it also affects those on a waiting list. So this has significant knock-on effects to the delivery of a service. Mm. So I think there is a huge opportunity there. I know the Mahoney report, and I'm not an expert on the legal. I'm only just an ordinary guy who went through this, and I want to share it so that it can be improved for others. And also for patients, because they have to wait a long period of time as well. So I think that there are a number of opportunities to improve the system.
You say I. Was this case taken by against the HSC or you personally or both?
Well, it's basically against the HSC.
Yeah. So with that in mind, then, sorry, and I'll come back to that. I'll circle back. Sorry, Michael. Yeah. I wonder then, you know, is this sort of the reality of the HSC's way it litigates, you know, dragging things, certain cases for years and years before settling on the steps of the High Court the day before something were to go to trial, for an example. In other words, there are question marks about how the HSC historically has dealt with these things. Has this had a negative impact in any way in your case, do you think?
Well, I wasn't specifically dealing with the HSC as such. Mm. The HSC employed the legal team to defend me. So I wasn't, they have their own procedure to engage. So, I think there are a number of areas that need to change, you know, starting from concise pleadings or whatever the plaintiff is saying is wrong. That needs to be made a little bit more concise. There needs to be deadlines. There needs to be clarity about the book of evidence and the discovery process of medical records.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, there are times, Greg, we all make mistakes as doctors. There needs to be admission of liability in the case where you're obviously wrong and settled. If I go back one step, Greg, unfortunately, or whatever way you like to look at it, GPs don't have the same luxury. There's a firewall there, and I wasn't actually physically named in the first case. But unfortunately, my colleagues in primary care are named. That is extremely traumatic. So, you know, I'll use an imaginary name now. I'd say Dr. Smith, a GP in Ector Island, you know, there's no such person. But they're actually, the action is against Dr. Smith in Ector Island and the HSC. At least I have the cushion of not being named. But for a family doctor, that's extremely stressful in a small community.
And it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, in that you have said, if I quote you correctly, that you would suggest that others do what you did and defend their name and defend their position if they believe that they are not liable or whatever the phraseology might be. But at the same time, you've recognised that, you know, I don't think everyone could actually go through it in terms of preparing your own defence, attending a high court in Dublin if you're based outside of it or even based within it. It's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it, the advice you're given, because you're saying if you can, you should, but you should also recognise what the toll that it will take on you.
Yes, and I think it depends on what stage you are at your career. I mean, if you're young, I could see you potentially giving up medicine after an episode like this. If you're old, you become disillusioned and potentially retire. And if you're middle-aged, you're trying to run your practice, be it in a hospital or be it in primary care. So I think that, you know, we need to look at having dedicated clinical negligence lists. And this is a big ask for high court judges and others to actually have an understanding of the complexities of medicine or surgery. I mean, it takes us, you know, 10 years to, or even longer. We never stop learning, Greg. But it is a big ask in certain cases. So, you know, breast cancer is one specific area, but you may have emergency surgery or bowel cancer or something like that. So I think dedicated clinical negligence lists would be really important. And I think we need to look at the expert panels. Greg, these are people who review a case and they say, well, we feel that there has been a breach of duty or that the doctor didn't do the right thing. Now, often these are outside the country. Mm. And in the case that I was involved in, there was significant criticism of the expert witnesses by the judge. And this is important. That we have fairness in the system.
Yeah, and finally, what impact, God, yeah, I mean, from your perspective, if there had been a settlement or, we'll focus on that, say, for instance, there had been a settlement, what would this have meant to you and your career, if you know what I mean? Say, for instance, you says, listen, I literally cannot commit to what would be required to clear my name. Would it be so severe that it would almost tarnish your life's work in your mind?
Yes. Well, I would, you know, I would live with that, and I would be very upset that this has happened. And I know I can think of three or four surgeons in the country that this has happened to. And I know some of them have retired, some of them left, and you know, there are times when there needs to be a more fair, robust system. And it's the time involved, because my particular case went to the High Court and then it went to the Court of Appeal. And that was, that was a prolonged process as well. So that's a very significant involvement. And both cases were, the case was obviously found in my favour, or the favour of the HSE, if you want to use that term.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Michael Sugrue, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Grainne McGuinness is from Letterkenny and is creative director of Paper Owl Films. Lovely to have you on the programme. Good morning to you, Grainne.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Talk to me about Paper Owl Films.
Well, Paper Owl, you have to say owl. Because I try to say owl.
And sounds like owl, like an owl.
Nobody gets it.
I'm an old man.
Paper Owl Films is myself and Gavin Halpin, who is also from Letterkenny, and Stephen Pettigrew, who sadly is not from Letterkenny, but who can't have it all. We started up the company in 2012, nearly 15 years old now. And we set up the company to make content that has meaningful takeaways for children. And we've been having a great time doing that ever since.
Now, we're talking about a new autism cartoon series. It's called Pablo's Next Level. And it airs from the 7th of September. So what is the idea behind this cartoon?
So Pablo is a really creative little boy, and we made a preschool show of Pablo. We did 104 episodes of Pablo that was commissioned by RTE and CBeebies, and it sold all over the world. And all our writers are autistic and our voice actors, and they had just so many stories about school that we decided to create this new spin-off series called Pablo Next Level, which sees Pablo as 8 and joining a mainstream school, and it's very complicated, and he's working it out one very funny drama at a time.
So he would presumably share the experiences that many of those that have worked on this cartoon have, and of course, that many people watching will be able to relate to.
Absolutely. Every single episode is grounded in the real life experience of an autistic writer or comedian. And we see the whole world of school through that lens. And that's a different point of view than is usually represented in mainstream media. So it allows us the opportunity to see the world in a different way.
Yes. So what kind of in the upcoming episodes, so what kind of school scenarios does Pablo encounter?
Well, there's a brilliant one about being told what to do. And when Pablo's told what to do, it fills him full of so many scribbly feelings, as he calls it, that he has to wait until his feelings go away before he can actually do the thing. So his shoelaces are open. He knows he has to tie them. But every time someone comes along and says, Pablo, you know, you should really tie those shoelaces, it makes him not want to do it. So he can't do it. So there's a whole episode about that, which is really insightful.
So how do we believe that if there is a child with autism watching that and they see Pablo acting or reacting, sorry, the way he's reacting, how does that actually help them? Or is it designed to help them, or is it designed for them to be able to relate to somebody else? Like, what is happening in this process of a child with autism watching a cartoon character with autism being asked to tie their laces but saying they don't want to do it?
Well, the first thing is representation on screen is a very powerful thing, because it validates our experience and it tells us we're not the only one. But that's not the, if we were just talking to autistic people in this series, we'd be preaching to the choir, because autistic people know that the world needs to change and how it should change. What this series does is it shows us what's going on the inside for Pablo, and the contrast then with what the world sees. So the world learns that actually, if Pablo is forced to make eye contact with the teacher, then he can't hear the teacher, because all his focus and processing power is going into maintaining that eye contact thing that he can't do. So it's for the rest of the world to really see that simple things could make a very big difference. And things that are vital for Pablo are actually good for us all and create engagement with us all. And we need all kinds of minds engaging together for a better world.
Yes, indeed. And I'm not challenging the concept at all. I just really want a full understanding of it. This is a product, though, that is directed to children 5 to 8 who are heading into a more busier school environment or a different school environment. You know, the moms and dads and the teachers and the other people out in the world might not actually see it. So how do you make sure you're not preaching to the converted?
Well, it's aimed at all children. We need big audiences. So we've got broadcasters that believe in the show with RTE and CBBC. And they, you know, children, you know, all children will watch the show because it's a really funny show. And we're laughing at the world in the show. We're laughing at the small stuff that we sweat. We're laughing at the rules that don't make sense. And when we're laughing at things like that, we can see how to change them.
Yeah, I get you. And just in terms of producing, I haven't actually seen I haven't actually seen an episode, to be completely honest, so I don't know how it's animated. Is it by computer AI or stop go or whatever? So can you explain, you know, how it is produced, and I suppose, you know, how long it takes to produce an episode?
Well, it's taken about 6 years to get the whole series produced, the 40 episodes. The very first thing that we do is we record the voices. That's the acting. And a lot of those voices are autistic actors. So that lays down the acting for the storyboard artists to then start drawing and coming up with visual gags and figuring out. Animation's amazing because anything can happen. So when you take those words from being words on a page to pictures on a screen, there's a whole visual journey there that really creative people get behind and plus. And then from storyboard, then that's all timed out to the voice track. And then we go into the animation process, which takes months and months.
Wow, it's an amazing
and it's
commitment.
Done by big teams of people.
Astonishing, astonishing piece of work. I mean, obviously, it's also too supporting so many people in their employment and job opportunities and everything. It's a real ecosystem that benefits many, and it's fantastic. For any company, but particularly one so close to home, to get the platform of both RTE and the BBC, it's a real testament to how it's been received by them. And you know what happens next? It goes all over the place, and presumably, foreign language narration can factor into this as well, because the animation is there. So the world's the oyster.
Yeah, we were very lucky to have Crayola Studios as our partner on this. And we also have an international distributor with Cake Entertainment. So it's their job now to take it out into the world. The preschool series sold in 190 territories and was translated into 35 languages. So I didn't even know there were 190 territories. But hopefully we can beat that now with this one.
Okay, brilliant. Well, listen, I'm going to end up going watching episodes now, the same as many listeners will, if they haven't already. I know it's already had a massive audience. It just hasn't come across my my desk yet. Listen, thank you so much, Grainne. Congratulations to you and the team on this. It's an amazing and really committed piece of work. Thank you.
Can I just say
that? Of course you can.
It transmits for the first time next Monday. So the Pablo Preschool is still there on RTE Junior, but on RTE Kids from next Monday, you'll be able to watch Pablo Next Level.
Excellent. That was exactly what I was going to do before the news, so you've saved me a job. Thank you very much indeed. Look after yourself. That's Grainne McGuinness there. We're joined on the programme by Independent Deputy Michael Collins. Good morning to you, Deputy. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Gray.
There are many people listening who frequent pubs, and it's often in the daytime but not exclusively, would have seen an informal situation whereby bets were taken at the bar and subsequently placed at the bookies next door or whatever it might be. I didn't realise this was relatively widespread, if I framed it correctly. That's what we're talking about. And, it is a relatively common practice then, is it?
It is, and it was certainly a very strong and common practice that people came to the rural pub, especially in areas, and there's so many where there's no bookies agents or bookie shops, and people into a pub, and they obviously bought a drink and said, put a fiver on a horse there, or put a fiver on the match, or put a tenner on the match. And now that's been completely blocked. Now, there was regulation before this blocking, but there's severe fines attached to it now. And we're not one bit afraid of regulation. That's very, very important. But to me, this is a sledgehammer cracking a very small nut in relation to the small, tiny bits that the rural pub was helping their customer take out, which is very unfortunate. Me as a leader of Independent Ireland and the Independent Ireland Party are very strong in feeling that the government must relook at this and, I suppose, amend the new gambling regulation to recognise the unique role of a rural pub in playing in communities and small bets now, not big betting situation, but small bets should be allowed in a small rural pub.
So what actually changed then? Because I know from my experience back in the day, it wasn't necessarily under the counter, but it wasn't necessarily advertised either. But it went on. So when you say there's been a crackdown on it or a toughening of sanction, what's actually happened and when?
Well, yes, that came out in the last week where you're talking about beer fines being applied to anyone caught to carry out the five euro or the 10 euro bet from a rural pub. So I think the publicans obviously are saying absolutely they can't at this stage. But at the same time, the argument they're putting up to me is that somebody would like to come in, again, small-time bet on the Grand National, on the All-Ireland or the World Cup or something like that, and want to put a fiver on something. Small-time bet, it's not that they're hooked on gambling or anything. It's just that they'd like to hear down the road or somewhere that horse might win or that football team might win. And all they want is a hurling game or whatever. And all they want is just put a small bit. And the problem is the system, by doing that, there was nothing illegal going on. It was very simplified. And now that's been blocked. And I think it's wrong. I just think that the gambling regulation department are kind of looking at everything in a huge spotlight, that everybody's, that they're there, I suppose, they're trying to tackle, we say, the serious gambling, and there is serious sad situations out there in relation to serious gambling, but this is very, very small time. Mm. And we believe that the fiver or the tenner bit should be allowed to continue in the local rural
bump. And I get where you're coming from, and the way you frame it, it sounds cutesy, and sure, it's a fiver and 250 each way and all that type of stuff, but how do you limit that from someone saying, you know, I want to put 200 quid on United to come from behind to beat Ipswich? Like, how you know, the reality is yes, there are those little flutters, but there's also some serious gambling goes on. We've all seen it. So how do you maintain it to the smaller figures like you talk of?
Well, I think that, you know, if there was if the gambling regulator and the department looked at it in a more serious light and were able to identify and they can do anything today with apps or whatever, that the publican that's carrying out the bet on behalf of a customer, that can be clearly identified as a small-time bet, not as a serious type mm-hmm. of bet in the middle of a match or whatever, more small-time. So, as I said, all these things can be sorted out. If there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah, I'm not sure on this one, though, Deputy, because, I mean, obviously you've got the Gardaí that are concerned about money laundering, and you can see where that might be. You've got the betting industry itself, your bookmakers that don't want this happening, you know, obviously the authority that you've mentioned. So all of the main players disagree with you, except...
I know, and that's... Except the punter and except the small-time public. You have situations, and it's happening quite a lot in rural towns and villages, there is no bookies. And there's no bookie agent as such. So, like, basically, and you have the situation where the elderly person comes in, they don't, maybe some don't have a mobile phone, but they certainly wouldn't have apps on their phone. And they usually used to, you know, have that little bit of a, what's the word, a flutter, whatever. I don't myself, but I'm only just saying, at least that was accommodated in a very small way. And it worked very, very carefully. And there was no money laundering in the fiver and the tinners, but unfortunately, you know, that's blocked them. And they won't be able to bet again because there's no betting agent in the town and the village. So these publicans were really trying to help people in very rural settings that would like to just do a small little bit of a bit, and are now being blocked at that going forward. Which
I know what you're saying, and you keep saying it's a small little bit, but I've drank in these pubs back in a different lifetime, and it wasn't always that. And then you had sometimes where the bar staff would cover the bet themselves because they thought it was a no-hoper, and next thing it'd be rows and arguments, and not to mention other halves at home. You know, they could be struggling financially, and primarily he's out having a few pints, and now he's also gambling in the pub at the same time as well. I understand exactly where you're coming from, and it harks back to maybe a different Ireland, Deputy, could I argue?
Yeah, you can, absolutely, but people have contacted us in relation to different TDs in relation to this issue and are concerned about it. The publicans have contacted us because they felt they were providing a small-time service to their customers, and we're happy to do that. And the punter was out there, okay, you know, you have situations where there is people that have gambling addictions, and that's a very sad situation. But in most cases that we're talking about, it's the All-Ireland final, the hurling, the football, the Grand National. It wouldn't be on a daily or a continuous basis. It would be just on a frequent situation where they say, oh, God, well, we hope Mayo will win this year, so let's put a tenner on Mayo.
Okay,
and they would have had a good payout. But how many years do they lose that tenner if they put it on Mayo previously? So it was giving people a small opportunity, and we feel that should be continued in a rural pub. Just keep it nice, keep it calm, keep it low, and keep it controlled. And that's where we felt Independent Ireland that was a strong argument for it.
Yeah, okay, we'll see what the public think. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Deputy Michael Collins, Independent there, 086 60 25,000. Do you remember we were chatting to Gemma earlier in the week? Now, Gemma lives on Ironmore Island and has a daughter with additional needs and couldn't get a bus from Burtonport to the school where the school could give her daughter, I think it's a daughter, it could have been a son actually for that matter, the best opportunity to maximise their potential. Well, good news, Gemma got a call from Bus Éireann to say that her daughter now will be picked up in Burton Port and taken to the boat and back. So that means that she still has to travel over on the boat with her child, which is arguably maybe it's a fact of island life, and I'm not sure what the alternative might have been. But in any case, the good news here is that Gemma's child has a seat and will be picked up at Burton Port and brought to her school. So it's always good to get stuff out there on the airwaves, by the way, I should say. We were talking to Mr. Michael Sugru earlier on about a battle that I didn't know at all about. Someone had taken an action against him, and it went to the High Court, and he was successful, and it was appealed, and he was successful there as well. And I'm thinking also on the person that took that claim. I'm sure they didn't do it out of any malice and had a strongly held belief. I get that. I understand that. But, of course, the courts, High Court and the Appeal Court found in Mr. Sugru's favour that there was no wrongdoing. But this caller says Mr. Sugru was the most beautiful person, surgeon in Letterkenny University Hospital. I'm so sad to hear him on air with you telling this today. I have attended Mr. Sugru for many years. He's amazing. What a loss to Letterkenny. He's such a great system and he's just the best surgeon. He removed a few lumps for me. He is so thorough. Another, I wish him a happy retirement and want to say that he was an amazing doctor. And I also want to say that he was a guest on the Greg Hughes podcast, which is live for you to listen to whenever you wish on our website, highlandradio.com. Just search the Greg Hughes podcast or wherever you get your podcasts, be it Spotify, Apple iTunes, wherever at all. We've so many fantastic guests and amongst them, Mr. Michael Sugru, where he reflects on his life, his career, more than I knew. Obviously, we know him from Letterkenny University Hospital, but he's incredibly well-travelled. And also, he talks about his decision to retire and what is next. That's a podcast available for you to listen whenever you like. So just Google the Greg Hughes podcast, Michael Sugru, and it will come up for you. Our guest this week is Doreen Sheridan Kennedy. Very interesting lady, of course, Fine Gael through and through. She bleeds blue. And we had an interesting chat, a bit of fun, a bit of knocking of heads, and just generally speaking, a nice chat too. So that's the latest episode. And we've a cracker coming up for you on Friday as well. So in other words, if you're, you know, you're working at home or you're out in the car, you're going for your walk and you want to listen to something a little bit different, maybe you don't feel like music that day, even though we play fantastic music here on the radio station, of course, feel free to pop on the Greg Hughes podcast, subscribe, like on Spotify, Apple iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, on our website, highlandradio.com, and away you go. And you've got about 35 hours of content that you may not have listened to and some amazing guests, let me tell you. Right, Community Garda information is on the way. I just want to give you a quick reminder, if you don't mind, because you could win €12,000 or a share of €12,000 this Friday. We have the big one to come. It's all part of the Super Summer Cash Draw here on Highland Radio. And we've got €12,000 to give away for you on Friday, €2,000 on the naughty alarm clock, and then 10,000 on this show. So someone is going to pocket 10K. It's the biggest chunk of the €20,000 that we've had to give away, and it's not too late for you to get your ticket. Let me tell you, again, I'll remind you, this is a competition that is for us. We do not market it in Cavan, in Cork, in Mayo, in Dublin. What it is here on Highland for our Highland listeners across the Northwest, and all of our winners, as far as I can recall, all of our winners actually have been from Donegal. But you can buy a ticket wherever you are, don't get me wrong. But my point is that it's not one in 50,000, right? Or one in 250,000. So there's still two big chances to win. You could still win the big cash prize, 10 grand on this show on Friday. If you want to get your tickets to be in both draws, I'd get in on it right now, because that winning ticket may still be in a book somewhere. It may not have been bought yet. Give us a call here, 07491 25000. We'll get your ticket sorted for you, or you can go onto the website, highlandradio.com. Please only play if you have a little bit of spare cash and you can have a bit of fun with your hard-earned money. It's €15 for one ticket, but I'm tight. I'd be going halves with someone and getting the five tickets for 50 if it were I. Garda Grainne Doherty is going to join me very shortly for Community Garda information. Stay where you are. Okay, Tuesday, the 1st of September, it is time for Community Garda information. We welcome back into studio Garda Grainne Doherty. Thank you very much for joining us, Grainne.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Great to have you up. Okay, let's get straight into it. Quite a bit to get to. We're going to start with actually two assaults, both in the Inishowen areas. We'll start with Bridge End. This is really quite recent.
Yes, this was a very recent incident. So, Gardaí, you're seeking witnesses in connection with an assault incident. This occurred at a filling station in Bridge End on the night of Monday, the 31st of August, at approximately 9:10 p.m. We're appealing to anybody who might have travelled within the area of Bridge End Village itself or along the Derry Bridge End Road between 8:45 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. last night with a dash cam to make that footage available to us. And if anybody can assist with relevant information, they're asked to contact Gardaí in Buncrana on 932 0540 or the Garda Confidential line on 1800 666 111. So it's very fresh today in people's heads. You know, if they were on that route, hopefully somebody will have dash cam footage that they'll
oblige. Yes, and it may not have purged or whatever it might be. It depends on which dash cam people have. But yeah, it's fresh in people's memories now and it's early in the evening. 10 past 9. Right, let's go to Main Street, Buncrana now, the day before.
Yes, Gardaí, you're investigating an alleged assault. This occurred at Main Street, Buncrana, in the early hours of Sunday, the 30th of August, in and around 4:10 a.m. So Gardaí received a report around that time in relation to a man who had been involved in a fight and he was lying on the street. So the ambulance crew attended the scene. They transported this injured man to Letterkenny University Hospital to receive medical treatment for serious but non-life-threatening injuries. We're appealing to anybody who might have been in that area around that time and who might have witnessed what happened just to get in touch with Gardaí in Buncrana on 932 0540. And as always, we're appealing to anybody who might have travelled along Main Street, Buncrana, between 3:45 a.m. and 4:10 a.m. on Saturday morning with a dash cam to make that footage available to us.
Yeah, for sure. Now, let's go to Killigordon. Criminal damage or alleged criminal damage being investigated.
Yes.
There.
So this criminal damage incident occurred at Inclareen, Killigordon, shortly after 11:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 27th of August. So a car had been parked up in the driveway of a house in that area and is believed to have been set alight at that time. Fire services attended the scene. They extinguished the fire. A number of neighbouring houses also had to be evacuated until the area was deemed safe again. We're appealing to anybody who might have travelled within the general Killigordon area or within that Inclareen area with a dash cam between 11 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. that night to make that footage available to us. We're particularly interested in speaking to anybody who might have observed two males on foot in the area around that time. Any relevant information should be passed on to Gardaí in Ballyshannon on 071 985 8530, and as always the Garda Confidential line can be contacted on 1800 666 111.
I mean, that's a very serious crime in and of itself, but the nature of it and the location, I mean, it could be so much, much worse.
Yeah, it could have escalated. It could have been so much worse. And even, you know, the fact that people had to be evacuated from their homes, possibly children
and
in their beds.
And putting the fire service in danger as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, it's a tricky thing to deal with. Right. Okay, we'll go to the south of the county now and an incident of criminal damage being investigated there.
Yeah, so we were only recently made aware of these incidents, actually, and we wanted to highlight them today because I think it's quite an ongoing issue. It's an issue of worry for the people in the community. So this report came in recently in relation to instances of criminal damage that have occurred at the Church of Our Lady, Star of the Sea in Bundoran. These incidents are believed to have occurred between August 1st and August 8th. So damage was caused to the church railings and graffiti was sprayed also on the stonework between those dates. So we're appealing to anybody who might have relevant information in relation to these acts of criminal damage to contact Gardaí in Ballyshannon on 071 985 8530.
Now, are these sort of a series of separate events, or is there anything happening in that area of note that?
It has been noted that a gang of youths or a number of youths have been frequenting that area late in the evening time and at night time. And of course, look, we're not saying that they're responsible, but this has been noted that this has been happening. So we're asking the public, please contact Gardaí immediately. If you ever observe a gang of youths in or around the church grounds.
Yeah, and what it sounds like in an effort to get to the bottom of this, if you see any group of youths in the area, and they may well be innocent in the area, to contact Gardaí so they can be eliminated from the inquiries.
Exactly. And look, it could be something totally innocent. They could be meeting up with their mates for a chat and just hanging out. You know, and it could be something totally innocent. But just in and around the church grounds, they have no place to be there.
I suppose it's at this time, it's this church, but we have heard of instances at other churches, and they are spaces I think we need to protect. Would you extend that advice to the wider community that if you see any type of activity or gatherings in and around church spaces that looks unusual, to contact Gardaí?
Of course, and as you know, Greg, over the past number of years, we often have incidents of theft, say even from collection boxes at churches. You know, there's been numerous types of incidents, churches and chapels, and so any place of worship, really, they're a sacred place. And if anybody ever observes any type of suspicious activity, people or vehicles in and around any of these types of places, please contact us. Don't hesitate. Give us a ring. Could be something totally innocent, as I say, but just we'd like to, you know, just go out and check the matter out.
Okay, let's go to the another theft. It comes up for now and again in and around the Letterkenny, quite often the Letterkenny area. This is the theft of an e-scooter.
Yes, this theft of a black Ninebot e-scooter. This happened at the car park at Letterkenny Shopping Centre on Sunday, the 30th of August. So it happened at actually 6:18 a.m. So CCTV has been viewed and they've pinpointed that time, 6:18 a.m. A man entered the car park, stole the e-scooter, and the e-scooter actually, interestingly, had been locked. I know we're always giving out advice, love, but this one had been locked. Okay. So this person did the right thing. They locked their e-scooter, but that lock obviously was then broken and the e-scooter was stolen. So this man left in the direction of the bus station roundabout there, headed on up the Port Road, Main Street, and headed on down towards Lower Main Street. He was wearing a black baseball cap, a red checked shirt, jeans, blue jeans, I believe, and black trainers. And he was carrying a black backpack also. So if anybody travelled in any of those areas between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. on that date with a dash cam, please make that footage available to us. If anybody can assist with any relevant information, please contact Gardaí in Letterkenny on 91 67 100. And of course, as always, if anybody comes across a similar type of e-scooter for sale on a second-hand basis, just alert us so we can check that out.
Yeah, because, I mean, some people do have some front, but to continue to use that locally, you know, when it's reasonably identifiable would be strange. So definitely keep an eye out for that. Okay. Regrettable that the person, as you mentioned, did the right thing, had it locked, but this person was determined to nick it.
Exactly. Yeah. And look, hopefully too, you know, the early hours of a Sunday morning, there would quite often be taxi drivers still in the area. Yeah. So hopefully, and they would most often have a dash cam. And if they noticed even this man on foot, just give us a shout.
Well, it's a very distinctive outfit.
It is. Yeah.
So that might help. Right. Road traffic collision being investigated in Letterkenny Town.
Yes, this collision occurred at Lower Main Street, Letterkenny, on Saturday, the 29th of August at 9:08 p.m. It occurred between a vehicle and a pedestrian. So the pedestrian was conveyed to Letterkenny University Hospital to receive treatment for non-life-threatening injuries. We're appealing to anybody who might have observed this collision to contact Gardaí in Letterkenny on 91 67 100, and as always, the dash cam footage from that area, we're seeking it also.
Right, motorists are being asked to slow down again. You do see it out there, you know. This morning the weather was brutal. It might have been pure dry in the west of the county, but where I was, it was brutal. There was tractors on the road. There was school children standing on the roads. No coats. But anyway, that's...
it's not cool to wear a coat anymore, apparently, I'm told.
Yeah, I think that seems to be the thing. But buses, they have to stop in the middle of the road in some cases. It depends, because there's nowhere for them. So there's so much traffic. There are delays and there's impatience out there. And, you know, we really need to check ourselves to ensure that we're breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth and driving safely, because that one wee chance you take and bang, it's done.
Yeah, and I suppose we've been spoiled maybe for the past number of months in the mornings getting in and out to work. You know, we've become used to that, and then the impatience does kick in, I suppose, and the roads are busier. The schools are now reopened. I know we mentioned last week just about people just keeping that in mind, you know, keep your speed down, especially when you're approaching school areas, bus drop-off, collection points. And just know that, look, the traffic is going to be heavier. That's a fact of life. So just leave a wee bit earlier in the morning.
And another thing too, and I'm speaking to myself in case people think I'm being preachy, but I was behind the bus today. The bus stopped in the middle of the road. You could overtake it, but it probably would have been a bit dodgy. Mm. And it was to let five kids on. So in reality, those kids get on, that bus is pulling off in 30 seconds.
Yeah, it doesn't take
but
long.
But if I'd have said, right, I'm going to nip around this and cross over onto the checks in a way, firstly, that probably would have been breaking the law. I'm sure it would have been, although that vehicle was stationary. But what have I saved? You know, in terms of time, what have I saved? But a child could have walked out in front of that bus, for example.
Exactly, for the sake of waiting those extra 30 seconds.
Exactly, and it's thinking about it and saying it out loud and thinking out loud. But go ahead, sorry.
So, look, there was a road, there was a speed enforcement operation on yesterday for 24 hours. So in Garda Síochána, in partnership with the Road Safety Authority and other stakeholders, carried out this 24-hour nationwide speed enforcement operation on Monday the 31st. This initiative ran from midnight, on Sunday the 30th for a 24-hour period. It's aiming to promote safer driving and reduce speed-related collisions nationwide, and it coincides with the first full week of schools reopening. across the country when there will be higher volumes of traffic on our roads. And with an increase in road use comes a higher risk of fatal or serious injury road traffic collisions. So Gardaí were out on the roads across Donegal yesterday.
I think there's a particular focus on schools too.
Around school opening and closing times yesterday. But they were also out, you know, outside
generally
of those
speaking,
hours.
Yeah.
They were out at night time also. And they did issue quite a few fixed charge penalty notices. I was talking to some of the roads policing unit this morning, and quite a few fixed charge penalty notices were issued for speeding offences. And last night, I noticed this morning, so I just wanted to mention this one. A driver was arrested by Milford Roads Policing Unit in the early hours of this morning. So it was outside of the speed enforcement operation, but that's, you know, it's not just on those days. I see sometimes when you post on Facebook about these speed slowdown operations,
people think nothing else happens
any
other time.
Yeah, yeah, people sometimes comment and say, you know, well, what about the other days? Mm. And they are out the other days, and this just proves that. So it was outside of that operation, but this driver was detected in the Kilmacrenan area, and they were detected at 170 kilometres in a 100 kilometre speed zone. So they were arrested and they were charged to appear in court. So the faster a vehicle is travelling, the more severe the impact if you collide, and speeding can have devastating consequences for the driver, but for all other innocent road users. So we're just continuing to urge drivers to please slow down.
170 kilometres per hour. I mean, there's no chance in that situation. Right. I don't know really why we're talking about this, because some people will and some people won't. Some people need a lot of loving and some people don't. Now, it's hedge cutting season.
It is. So, it's hedge cutting season.
My point is this means that some people will and then some people just won't. But anyway,
yeah,
you
well,
can.
I suppose it ties in with what we were just talking about. Slow down.
Yep.
You know, expect large machinery to be on the roads today, the 1st of September. Roadside hedge cutting season commences today. You are going to see all types of larger type machinery out in the road. You know, if you're coming around a bend, it could be there.
Yep.
Keep it in mind. Please do slow down. Leave plenty of space so that you're in a position to stop suddenly should the need arise. And we're asking all drivers, please drive with care and to remain alert at all times. And landowners and farmers and these people that are out cutting the hedge, it's just, we're asking them also, please ensure that you're ensuring your safety and the safety of all other road users. You know, place the appropriate warning signs out in the road. Just let motorists know that you're hedge cutting in that area also.
Yes, indeed. And if you can cut your hedges, please do. Because delivery vans, your oil lorries, your school buses, you know, having to go up and down these roads, damaging paint, but also being able to pass other vehicles and the safety element of it as well. So if you do have a roadside hedge, it would be great if you could cut it, please, because you know what's going to happen next. And this is not Garda related, but we're going to start getting calls from people who are saying the hedges aren't being cut. The councillors are going to huff and puff about it and it won't get done. So we need to work together or come up with something outside of law enforcement or the media as to how we sort that out. Right. Now, scam alert. And the reason these come up, it's not, Granny doesn't type into ChatGPT, give me something to talk about, right? Although maybe you do, but you don't. This is based off, you know, you checking through the systems, you seeing what's popping up in Donegal, what reports you're getting, and you're saying, right, we need to get that out there because this is happening right now. So that's the basis of it. What is this latest scam we're seeing, Grania?
Yeah, well, I know the phones were hopping yesterday in Buncrana station. They were hopping in Letterkenny station in relation to this scam. So I don't know how these scams work, but it seems to have been circulating within Donegal yesterday. Our phones were hopping with people. It was all the same scam. So I want to make people aware, should they receive this call, it's fraudulent communication. So phone calls that have been occurring in the Donegal area, and these phone calls have been received from 0044 numbers, UK numbers, Irish mobile numbers also, and also it might come up as a private number. And they feature an automated message. They'll state that your vehicle has been alleged to have been involved in a hit-and-run collision. So automatically, it's to create the panic, the fear, you know, that we're aware your vehicle was involved in this hit-and-run collision. Then you're instructed to press 1 to connect members of An Garda Síochána in relation to the matter. So it's a scam. We're just asking people to be vigilant. Do not engage. Don't provide any personal or financial information during the call. And if you have engaged with this type of, or any type of scam, please contact your local Garda station. Now, we did try to find out, had anybody actually pressed one yesterday to see what type of information they're seeking. But sure, look, as always, it's going to be financial.
Well, I was of course, exactly. If you pay us €50 now or €5 or whatever it is to get your bank details, we'll get it purged for you, which is nonsense. Yeah, I got a contact from a listener, or at least the mother's a listener in West Donegal, and they were getting it last week.
Yeah.
Now, the saving grace was is that the mother didn't have a car. Never had a car.
Yeah,
so
the fear is that it would create panic within somebody, you know. And I mean, look, An Garda Síochána, if you're suspected to be involved in a hit and run collision, what's going to happen there is you're going to see a patrol car pull into your drive and the guards will be at your door. or else they're going to phone you. You know, you're not going to get enough. You're not going to have to press one or 10 or 15. No, yeah. No, old school. We'll be there at your door. Just
I mean, it's obvious. But I think really what they're doing is hit and run. I need to clear my name straight away. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. It's like every other scam, yeah.
The guards don't operate in that. They want you to panic and get it resolved as soon as possible. Maybe before you have to tell your partner or your dad or whomever it might be, right? Okay.
And look, good advice. If anybody did press one and did give away any sort of financial details or personal details, please do alert us. If you've given away any sort of financial details, your number one stop is the bank. Let them know, then come to us and make us aware of it.
Yeah, so you can contact the Gardaí for that. It's useful information for them. Or also pass it on to us and we can get it out to the wider population. I like when I call, they call me because I then go through, without giving details, I can go through the call and sort of determine what's going on. Garda Grainne, thank you so very much indeed. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, if you missed anything there, it's going to be available on our podcast, available on the website from about 20 past one, and you'll be able to watch it later on our Facebook and on Garda Síochána Síochána Facebook page as well. But it's back live with you after the 10 o'clock news next Tuesday. And thank you, by the way, to all of you who are messaging in. It is very, very much appreciated. Can you wish, I'll do a couple of requests actually. Can you wish Annette Doherty from Fawn a very happy birthday from all the family? Enjoy your day. Please wish Margaret Shields, Dunmore Carrigart a very happy birthday. Hope you have a great day from Susan, Pete and all the family. And also Mickey Callahan, Grove Hall, Remelton, 89 today. Have a great day from your loving wife, Madge. Normally get to them about 10, but it slipped my mind today. My apologies. Rightio. Let's go to author Frank Connolly. His latest book, Exposed: Scandals That Rocked the Irish State. Good morning to you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Greg. How are things?
Not too bad. And I mean, you had a wealth of source material, one could argue.
Absolutely. And there were plenty of tribunals that were digging into these stories, as you know, over the years. But what this book is about really is going back to how the stories came about. And I don't get involved really in the proceedings of the tribunals. That's all been done. But more look at the significance of the stories and then draw a thread to where the people are today that suffered from as the result of the activities of some members of the Garda in Donegal in that particular instance.
Just in relation to all of the various controversies and scandals that you investigated, was there any common theme in terms of trying to get them into the public light or trying to get almost dragging agencies, authorities, kicking and screaming to the table to try and get to the truth?
Absolutely. I mean, if we took the very first story that I concentrate on, which is the scandal that led to the resignation of Ray Burke as Minister for Foreign Affairs in 1997, I first published the story about an allegation that he received two amounts of $40,000 each in his home in 1989 from two different business people. I published that story in 1995. It took 2 years before we could get to a situation where we could actually get a response, firstly, and confirmation from Fianna Fáil and Mr. Burke in this instance that he was present in a room when money was handed over to him in 1989 during a general election campaign. And that, of course, their explanations and his explanations unraveled, resulting in his resignation a few months later. So there were serious legal threats. There was denials, the insistence that, you know, that none of this happened, until eventually the story itself unraveled and various witnesses came forward.
And I think what's going to be very interesting for people, and we'll get to some of the local interest, but these are national stories and everyone will recognise the controversies and the scandals that we've talked about. Sometimes it needs a bit of time, doesn't it? And then critical analysis that you've been doing for us, the reader, to sort of get the reality of what actually went on, because the dust has settled and it means that you can dig in and find out, you know, what led up to these big scandals that we're all so familiar with.
Yeah, well, I think that's an important point because, firstly, tribunals were established to look into the planning corruption allegations involving two whistleblowers, Jim Gogarty about Ray Burke, and then subsequently Tom Gilmartin, which took up a huge amount of the tribunal, which went on, remember, for 12, 15 years. It went from 1997 to 2012 before the final report was published. People couldn't find it very difficult to follow in depth this and other tribunals like the Moriarty Tribunal into payments to Larry and Charlie Haughey, and the Morris Tribunal, as you've mentioned, into the activities of Gardaí in the Northwest. They went on for so long. There were so many hundreds of witnesses. There was so much confusion, denial, confirmation, allegations, etc. And eventually there were, in the case of Morris, 8 reports, in the case of Moriarty, several, and similarly with the Mahon Flood Tribunals. And obviously the ordinary punter is not going to be able to follow that in depth, and certainly not read these huge volumes of material. The second point is that while you and I may remember some of this material, there's a whole generation that still don't know and understand what happened and the scale of this corruption in the 1980s and 90s that led to these huge investigations.
Yes, but also to even those who lived through it, you have a version's memory of it. You know, like, say, for instance, we covered the Morris Tribunal extensively here. People remember evidence, what the guards thought, what other people involved. But you can get past all of that and look at it objectively. And I think people will see, for example, the Morris Tribunal, what led up to that with more clarity than they, even if they believe they have that clarity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. And what I did was, just on that, is how did I gather the information? Well, I went back to all the articles I wrote for the Sunday Business Post and other publications, the Mail and Sunday and other outlets. And I actually spent 3 months, because the Business Post wasn't digitized, so I National Library pulled all those articles together and was able to draw a thread between the articles I was writing about the Larry Haughey situation that was going on, the investigation that led to the Moriarty Tribunal, and also all the stories that led up to the setting up and subsequently the revelations of the Mahon and Flood Tribunals. So really what this is, how the stories evolved. But more importantly, it's the significance of the people who brought those stories, the people like Gogarty, like Gilmartin, and several families in, as you know, in Donegal, the McBrearties, the Dibbers, the Shorts, and the Gallaghers, all of whom suffered really appallingly. Sheena McMahon, the wife of a former Garda detective, who, you know, had a gun put to her head. She was abused. She was threatened. She had her children taken off her. These stories are about human beings being absolutely tormented and abused. And that, to me, you've touched on that point, that to me is how those stories were lost to an extent.
Mm, yeah.
In a long process. And yeah, that's what this book is about.
And that sounds to me like there's a bit of discovery, even though you were fully immersed in these, that sort of being able to step back and even look at your own work, see threads that maybe you didn't spot at the time. I don't know. Now, in terms of, and it's important people buy the book because an awful lot of work went into this, so I'm not asking you to reveal everything, but in this process, certainly with the Morris Tribunal, and I think in the Kerry Baby situation as well, you're uncovering new information. So how in this process do you come across what will for the reader be new information, Frank?
I think when I embarked on this book about 20 months ago with the publisher, with Merriam Press, I wanted to be able to go back to how these stories evolved, as I've said, particularly for a younger audience, but also for the general public. And it meant revisiting the scene, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. and going back to Donegal and talking to the people, the family. I mean, some of the main characters obviously are dead. Jim Gogarty, Gilmartin had passed away, Fergus Flood, the chairman of the tribunal, and many others. In the course of that, I uncovered new information or more important information that wasn't properly examined by the tribunal in relation to the death of Richie Barron, for instance, in Rafoe in October 1996. And that information concerns the behaviour of two of the Gardaí. They were subject of major investigation at the time. The Garda on duty in Raphoe that evening, Pádraig Mulligan, and an off-duty Garda, John O'Dowd. And the evidence concerning their movements that night, to me, had never been properly analysed or addressed by the tribunal in its final report. Similarly, when it came to the Kerry Babies case, when I was in Donegal examining some of these and other issues, somebody told me a story which was shocking, beyond belief almost, because 40 years later, I was told the identity of the people who were most likely to have been involved in the death of baby John, the baby that was found in April 1984 on a beach in Cathair Savine with 28 stab wounds, an infant that had only been born a couple of days before. And as a result of that, I was able to establish, backed up by recent developments in the case involving DNA evidence pointing to the parents of the child, but I was able to find out more about the circumstances surrounding the appalling death, or the brutal death of that baby.
Okay, and it's all in the book, and you cover an awful lot of different stuff outside of what we've been talking about. Frank, I mean, you're a seasoned pro. There's probably very little you can learn. You've seen, you've been there, you've been reporting on all of this stuff. But I suppose when you looked at it in the way you have to compile this book, do you conclude anything about this country and how it's run in terms of policing, politics? Do you feel it's worse, it's a more corrupt, a more difficult country to get justice in or to get the truth? Did you know it already? Or maybe the situation isn't quite as bad as you might have feared. In all of you've done in the last 20-odd months putting this book together and the life's work in the source material, has the view of Ireland changed at all?
Well, the book was inspired by the appointment of Michael Lowry as a negotiator in the formation of the current government back in early 2025. Because, as you remember, all those years ago, when the Moriarty Tribunal report came out, among those who the tribunal was very critical of Michael Lowry and how he was involved in the award of the second mobile phone license, which was acquired by a businessman called Dennis O'Brien. And the tribunal came down very heavily to say that Lowry had been effectively remunerated as a result of that. We don't need to go over all that, but one of the things that was said at the time was by the current Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, in 2011, when that report came out castigating Lowry, and he called for his resignation and his dismissal from politics. Roll on the years, and here we are. Micheál Martin is sitting down negotiating the formation of a government with the same guy whose resignation he sought. That was one thing that inspired me. But also what you look at is, over those years, we are in a situation where there's vast amounts of money being spent in annually by government. You're talking about over close to 150 billion. This is no longer an issue of brown bags and envelopes being handed over in the homes of ministers or in pubs, indeed. This scale of public spending, the scale of potential abuse, the overspending and waste that we already experience, we know about it. We know about bicycle sheds and walls and all the other stuff that's come out, and hospital spending, you know, costing 2.5 billion, which was supposed to cost 700 million. But within that, while there have been regulations and regulators appointed on all of these various issues, in my view, the bodies that are set up to monitor and control and regulate the activities of politicians and the relationship between politics and business haven't functioned very well. For instance, the Standard and Public Office Commission has had one investigation in the last 3 years. That's a body that's supposed to investigate allegations. Now, there have been a number of allegations made. There's been an anti-corruption commission set up, I recount this in the book, for 4 years ago. It hasn't issued a report. Now, maybe that's because it can't find any corruption.
Now, we've a planning report sitting on a shelf somewhere.
And the Mahon Report Tribunal set out a whole series of recommendations, many of which have never been implemented. So, unfortunately, I can't give you a positive answer.
I think you did. I think you gave us the answer, whether we like it or not. The book is called Exposed Scandals That Rocked the Irish State, and people are going to be very interested in that. It's clearly going to continue to be a great success for you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Look after yourself. Frank Connolly there. You can get that book in the usual spots. I always wonder why Garda announced these national campaigns. Sure, that just acts as a warning for drivers to behave for the day. Surely only Garda should know this information and then they would be more effective. Listen, at the end of the day, do you keep that quiet and risk a child getting knocked down going to school, or do you put it out there and catch those that still won't even heed the warnings? It's a tricky one. You know, it's there are guards who don't mind speed vans being warned, you know, people being warned of speed vans. I'm not saying the force doesn't mind it, but there are some of the school of thought that says, well, do you know what? If that gets someone to slow down, well, then the job is done to some extent. Hi, Greg. This B word of a government wants to know everything about you and what you're doing with your money. And that's the way it's going for sure. I put $3,000 into a credit union a few weeks back. You'd think I was putting in 130,000 euro. Where did I get the money from? They asked. Yeah, and they're kind of obliged to. I do know what you're saying. I really do. Right, that's where we leave it on the show today. Thank you so much to all of you who listened to the programme, whether you texted, called in, emailed in. We appreciate it all. Don't forget you can listen to the podcast of the programme from 11:20 on our website. We're back live with you tomorrow morning at 9.